Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The Conservative Party won national elections in Australia this week. The coalition led by Tony Abbott unseated the Labour Party, which had held power for 6 years. We'll talk with a researcher from an international think tank in Sydney about the impact of the election on foreign policy, immigration, environmental issues, and the domestic agenda. But first, World Watch, our summary of international news with Raymond Tungekar.
Thanks, David.
Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with his Russian counterpart this week to discuss a Russian plan for disarming Syria of its chemical weapons. The proposal calls for the Syrian government to surrender its chemical weapons stockpiles to international monitors. The meeting comes just days after President Obama postponed a congressional vote authorizing the use of force in Syria. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin made a direct appeal to Americans on Wednesday, writing an op-ed in the New York Times that questioned the long-term success of a military strike against Syria. At least 60 people have been killed in the Central African Republic during clashes between fighters loyal to the ousted president and the rebels now holding power. The coup took place in March, but the violence intensified after rebel leader Michel Djotodia was sworn in as president last month. The United Nations warns that the resource-rich country is on the edge of becoming a failed state. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto is standing trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Ruto, along with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, are charged with crimes against humanity for allegedly inciting ethnic violence after the country's presidential elections in 2007. More than 1,000 people were killed in the conflict, with an additional 600,000 displaced. Ruto will stand trial first, with Kenyatta following in November. In India, prosecutors are recommending the death penalty in the case of four men convicted of gang raping a 23-year-old New Delhi student last December. The incident sparked a worldwide discussion on the safety of women in India. A judge is expected to deliver a sentence for the men on Friday. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the M23 rebels and the government have re-entered peace negotiations following an 18-month rebellion. The peace talks follow a recent battle near the border with Rwanda that compelled UN forces to intervene. Both parties met on Monday in Uganda to go over a draft peace deal and now will have 2 weeks to present amendments. Venezuela has formally withdrawn from the Organization of American States. President Nicolas Maduro took to Twitter to call the OAS a, quote, tool to protect U.S. geopolitical interests and harass progressive government. Bolivia, Ecuador, and Nicaragua have criticized the OAS, but Venezuela is the first Latin American country to withdraw. Human rights groups have expressed concern that the move will heighten corruption and political persecution in the country. Norway's Labour Party conceded after a landslide defeat to a right-leaning coalition on Monday, ending 8 years of centre-left rule. Incoming Prime Minister Erna Solberg will be the country's first conservative prime minister since 1990 and its second female leader. And that's it for World Watch.
Thank you, Raymond.
My pleasure.
Jack Georgieff is a research associate for the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. The Lowy Institute is an independent, nonpartisan international policy think tank located in Sydney. Welcome to our program.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you.
Let's listen to a bit of what Mr. Abbott had to say to supporters after his election.
I now look forward to forming a government that is competent, that is trustworthy, and which purposefully and steadfastly and methodically sets about delivering on our commitments to you, the Australian people.
Jack, Tony Abbott has become Australia's third Prime Minister in 3 months. That's a stretch of extraordinary political instability in Australia. Former Labour Prime Minister Bob Hawke said this election was lost by the government rather than won by Tony Abbott. What did he mean by that?
Well, the last 3 years preceding this election and going back to before the 2010 election have marked a rather extraordinary period of political history for us here in Australia. The Labor government that just lost office was first elected in November 2007 under Kevin Rudd in a victory that defeated the 11-year reign of John Howard's Liberal mm-hmm. Party. And in June 2010, in a party room coup, Julia Gillard seized the leadership of the Labor Party and the prime ministership from Kevin Rudd after he ran what was felt by his caucus colleagues as a dysfunctional government that was bound to lose the 2010 election. The 2010 result didn't result in a majority government, which is the norm for us here. It resulted in minority government where Julia Gillard had to negotiate with four crossbench independent and minor party members of parliament to retain office, which she did successfully. However, throughout the next 3 years, including policy reversals such as introducing a carbon tax, a fixed price on carbon, which she had pledged days before the 2010 election not to do, she reversed that stance, and that sort of signaled the start of what was something of a decline of her standing and her popularity, as well as that of the Australian Labor Parties. And it continued to go downwards for her, and Tony Abbott, as leader of the opposition, campaigned very hard against the carbon tax and against the Labor government, earning the nickname Dr. No for his way of saying no to anything that came across the House of Representatives for a vote. And
let's talk about Abbott. He seems to have benefited from this infighting and disarray in the Labor Party. He's 55, a former Rhodes Scholar and a trainee priest. What else should we know about him?
You should know that he is a very disciplined individual. He takes his sport very seriously. The first thing he did on Sunday morning after the election was go for his daily bike ride. He is someone who emphasises methodical process of cabinet and government, and he is someone who holds his beliefs very dear to his heart. The phrase conviction politician comes to mind with him for a lot of people. He's someone who is very interested in social justice issues. He trained to be a Jesuit priest in the 1980s, but was never ordained. And his Catholic faith is very, very dear to him. So those are some of the qualities that make up our new prime minister.
And his party won the biggest parliamentary majority since at least 2004, but he wasn't seen as a great candidate, was he? There was a few gaffes, particularly I think he made a few comments that women found objectionable.
He's made some comments in the past relating to his conservative views on abortion and the role of women in society. I think it's fair to say he's moderated those views quite a bit. He's got three grown daughters now, and he says as much himself that having three strong women around has moderated his views on a number of issues. But during the campaign against the carbon tax, there was an now infamous episode where he was campaigning against it outside Parliament House, and there was a number of disparaging signs towards Julia Gillard in rather offensive terms, which he was talking in front of, and that was sort of where Gillard picked up in her now infamous misogyny speech that she sort of cascaded through the floor of Parliament in October last year that went viral around the world. So he certainly has a reputation as a very conservative man, but to say that he's an anti-woman or anything along those lines is controversial at best amongst both supporters and opponents of Mr. Abbott.
Yeah, and he's also promised to fund a huge parental leave program. Isn't that right?
Yes, he has. He's promised a very generously paid parental leave program, more generous than the one currently available, and the Labor government that's just been booted out of office campaigned quite fiercely against it as they saw it as being unfair. It remains to be seen whether or not he'll actually get that through. It comes with a very huge cost to it. It's going to be funded partly through a levy on big business, and the Senate result is still uncertain at the moment, so it remains to be seen whether or not he'll actually get that through.
Right. And won't Abbott be forced to negotiate with minor parties in the Senate when he tries to scrap this carbon tax and the mining tax?
Yes, he will be. So our Senate that we've just elected this Saturday gone won't take office until the 1st of July next year. And until that time, the Labor Party and the Green Party hold the balance of power in the Senate, in that without the support of one or the other, the coalition can't get any legislation through. So until that time, it looks very unlikely that the carbon tax or the mining tax will be repealed. But after the 1st of July, the numbers are still uncertain at this stage, but it looks like the coalition will need to negotiate with about possibly anywhere between 6 to 9 crossbench senators from a range of different minor parties, but those individuals generally sort of veer to the right or certainly to the centre. So though getting those policy reversals through, axing the carbon tax, getting rid of the mining tax, will have a better chance from July next year.
Right. And why was this proposed levy okay for parental leave but not okay for the mining tax?
Some would say that the paid parental leave scheme was brought in to address perception problems Tony Abbott had with women, something of a vote grabber policy, if you will. And indeed, there has been criticism directed at the coalition that their policy makeup going into this election campaign was somewhat muddled, and that they are a party of small government and low taxes, but are trying to institute one of the most generous sort of welfare schemes in terms of paid parental leave in the world by imposing a levy on business. So those sorts of criticisms, because of the tumultuous Labor Party leadership debacle, those sort of policy questions didn't really see the light of day to the degree that possibly they should. But you can be sure that they will be addressed in the coming months as this legislation tries to make it through the parliament.
All right. And let's go back to the election campaign a bit. Now, Bloomberg reported last night that Australia recorded its first back-to-back jobs decline in more than 2 years, and unemployment has been rising since November, and it's now just shy of the highest rate during the global financial crisis 4 years ago. But it's still below 6%. How important was the unemployment issue in this election?
It was definitely an underlying factor that swayed many voters. Part of those statistics show that the number of full-time employed jobs has started to fall. So it's now becoming the case that more and more people are finding themselves underemployed, which is, I know, an issue that has been quite prescient in America for a number of years now. So the perception or the feel that the economy was softening and that the joblessness rate was going up certainly fed into the coalition narrative that the Labor government was overseeing the softening of an economy that, that could basically lead to a recession, although there are no firm signs yet that Australia is heading towards that. The only firm signs we have is that the economy is in for a softer period of less economic certainty than it has had in the past few years.
That kind of segues into the immigration issue. Let's talk about that. I'm wondering, that became a hot topic during the election campaigning, and the Conservative Party came out with a pretty strong stance on immigration. Before we get into the policy, are people there worried about immigrants taking jobs?
I would say that that comes very much from the Labor Party's union base. from there would be a perception amongst blue-collar workers that, yes, there are immigrants coming to take our jobs. You know, it's a popular narrative to spin in any Western country. I know it's spun in the United States as well. I wouldn't say there is widespread fear of a wave of immigration coming to Australia to take Australian jobs. That being said, if you try to talk about population policy in terms of whether or not Australia aims towards having a bigger population by the middle of the century or not, that's something that does worry people because, for instance, in Western Sydney and in Melbourne, Brisbane and Perth, some of these larger cities that are growing, concerns of what more population would mean for the daily commute, for the cost of housing, shop, consumer items, everyday needs, that weighs on people's minds. So to try and have a debate about the long-term future is one that's been stunted and one that sort of caused Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd trouble during their prime ministerships.
And what does Abbott say about what he wants to do about the immigration policy?
The coalition policy is to reverse the restriction on 457 visas. Those are visas that we bring in talented migrants from around the world with, and the Labor government, just before Parliament was dissolved, before the election, passed restrictions on those visas. It's very likely that you'll see the coalition try to reverse those in some manner, not necessarily straight away, but those restrictions were put in place at the behest of the and, you know, the constituents of the ruling Labor, then ruling Labor Party. So you don't be surprised to see those sorts of rules relaxed at some point during this term of Parliament, but it's not guaranteed.
Okay. Let's step back a bit. The country's voting process is very different from other Western parliamentary systems. All Australians 18 years or older are required to register and to vote in all these elections, which are held on Saturday when most people are off work and out of school. And voting is done on a preferential system with voters ranking their choice of candidates from first to last. What are some of the interesting aspects of Australia's voting system that's different from, for instance, our voting system in the U.S.?
For a start, you won't have political parties spending huge amounts of money on get-out-the-vote efforts, which I know was a very key part of President Obama's victory strategy in 2008 and 2012, because, of course, it's compulsory to vote here. That being said, the informal vote count, which is that where a vote is not done properly or is purposefully graffitied and therefore can't be counted in any way, that has reached an all-time high in this election, and that's a worrying trend for politicians of all stripes. And there are noises being made by the incoming government about what could be done to address that. And also, we did have, whilst we have compulsory voting and you are fined if you don't vote, we did have quite a few voters just not turn up to vote this time as well. I'm not quite sure what the exact numbers are. They're still tallying all the official results.
How much is the fine?
I believe it's around about $50, but I was good enough to vote in this election, so I don't actually... won't actually find out.
All right, I want to ask you who you voted for. And what sort of things do apathetic voters do? You mentioned a few, and I've heard of this tactic called the donkey vote.
The donkey vote, as best as I understand it, is where in mainly you will sort of vote for a party that's not really got any hope of making it through. This was used particularly sort of in the Senate, and actually. There was one senator who's most likely been elected in New South Wales, standing for the Liberal Democratic Party, and the Liberal Democratic Party, because there were 110 candidates below the line in the Senate ballot paper for New South Wales, so that was a very long ballot paper. So he was placed, that his party was placed before the Liberal Party, the main party of the coalition. So he received, I think in 2007, they only received 2% of the vote. This time they've received about 8% of the vote because of the donkey vote, that being people who vote for them because they aren't quite sure who to vote for or think, or they think they are voting for the real Liberal Party when in fact they're not.
And the election season is quite a bit shorter than the season here in the US, isn't that right?
Yes, the campaign proper lasts usually only about 4 to 5 weeks when Parliament is officially dissolved by the Governor General. That's the starting shots are fired, and it's a very quick sprint of 4 to 5 weeks. That being said, though, because of the instability or uncertainty of the minority government of the last few years, an election's been more likely than not. Because of the possibility of the independents pulling their support from the Labor government. So if you speak to some Australians, they would say that we haven't stopped being in campaign mode since the 2010 election.
Okay. And let's before we move on to foreign policy issues, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website, such as a description of Australia's unusual election system and a report on Australia's media concentration led by Rupert Murdoch. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Jack, let's talk a bit about foreign policy. Now, didn't Abbott say that he was in favor of the invasion of Iraq?
Yes, he did. He was a minister in John Howard's government, and the Howard government at the time was a very staunch supporter in the coalition of the willing with the Bush administration in invading Iraq. And Abbott used some rhetoric at the time that is not unlike that of the neoconservatives in the United States, in terms of liberal values should be spread wherever they can.
Didn't he call it an altruistic war, to quote, liberate other people, advance everyone's interests, and uphold universal values? A colleague of yours wrote that this kind of language, quote, suggests an almost limitless appetite for military interventionism.
Yes, and that was certainly the flavor of the day in 2003. However, today, I think it's fair to say that such language wouldn't be used by our Prime Minister-elect. He, for instance, with the Syria crisis that's ongoing and very much unfolding day by day at the moment, he has taken, in his rhetoric thus far, he's taken a very cautious approach, offering support for the United States and whatever actions they may choose to take, but certainly not offering any or not imploring any boots on the ground. In mm-hmm. fact, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any Western leader advocating that position today.
And what are some other possible changes in foreign policy that could happen under the Abbott's coalition? Will he be as friendly toward the U.S. as Labor had been?
Oh, absolutely. The coalition consider themselves the gatekeepers of US-Australia relations and the alliance. It is very much in their political DNA. It's something that, if anything, was more sort of adopted by Labor by necessity. They're the ones who still maintain a minority anti-US grouping within their party. The coalition doesn't have any such constituency at all. You can expect relations to be built upon that of what Howard and Bush worked on together, as well as Gillard and Obama, who both those sets of leaders enjoyed very warm personal relations. So you can mm-hmm. expect Tony Abbott to try and build very warm personal relations with President Obama, despite their very, very different world outlooks in some respects in terms of their domestic political philosophies. But no, you can certainly expect the ongoing marine rotation in Darwin to continue, and you can expect the yearly Osman dialogues to prove fruitful in whatever both sides of the alliance require. For instance, in 2011, I believe it was, there was an agreement to apply the ANZUS Treaty to cyber attacks, and you can expect that sort of policy sort of articulation to continue under a coalition government.
And if, say, the international effort to get rid of Syria's chemical weapons fails and President Obama pushes ahead for military action in Syria, what would your prediction be about how the how Abbott would respond to that?
Well, Tony Abbott just got a phone call from President Obama just today, in fact, our time, and he congratulated Obama on a very fine speech on Syria and said that Australia, in the event of action being taken by America against Syria, will lend moral support to America in that. I would doubt you would hear much else beyond that.
Okay. And what about Australia's policy toward China? How do you see that changing or possibly staying the same with the Abbott coalition?
The Gillard government very much made Australia-China relations a core focus, and one of their legacies will be building strong foundations for Tony Abbott and Julie Bishop, our incoming foreign minister, to build upon that. This year, in April, Julia Gillard was able to get the agreement of the Chinese government for an annual strategic dialogue between the top ministers of each government, which is something that I believe only the United States, Britain, and Germany enjoy with China on an annual basis. So you can expect Julie Bishop and her ministerial colleagues to make full use of those of that dialogue platform. China is also an incredibly important economic partner for Australia, and you can expect further moves to be made in terms of encouraging Chinese investment, even though the junior coalition partner, the Nationals, do have some fears about foreign investment. You can expect the Liberal Tony Abbott government to continue to support close economic relations with China, and you can also expect it to see it expand through what they call their new Colombo plan, which is a revision or a reversal of what happened in the 1950s under the Menzies government, where they brought students from all over Asia to get educated in Australia at a university level. What their plan will do is it will send Australian students out into all parts of Asia, and China will be a focal point of this.
Well, thank you, Jack. This has been a very illuminating conversation about Australia's elections.
Thanks very much for having me.
Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today from Sydney was Jack Georgeff of the Lowy Institute for International Policy. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Casey Morrell was this week's lead producer. Thank you for joining Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.